On today's show, we take a look at Google Now on iOS and ask what this means for Apple, discuss Twitter security problems in light of Associated Press being hacked, and later on in the show, we chat to the founder and CEO of Soundwave, Brendan O'Driscoll, about how the app aims to improve social music. And you're very welcome to the show. I'm Quinton O'Reilly, and I'm joined here by our client service manager, Lisa O'Brien. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Quinton.
And our creative director, Aaron Goodliffe. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, Quinton. How are you?
And so we'll start off with the news that Google Now is on iPhone and iPad. It's by far one of the best apps on Android, and it's made its way over to its main rivals, which is a pretty good move for Google, maybe not so much for Apple. But Aaron, if we can start with you first. Is it surprising that Apple allowed this to go into the App Store in the first place?
I don't think they can really restrict it. I mean, it's such a nice piece of kit. I mean, I've been using it. It's a bit awkward to be just using it all the time. I mean, it's a search function. I actually didn't even use the Google search app beforehand. It would just, whatever, it was on Safari and all. But when the upgrade happened, and Niall has been going on about it nonstop in terms of, oh, look at my Google Now. It's telling me when I need to go to the airport. And it's like, well, that's incredibly lazy. But it is extremely cool when you're getting Google Now telling you need to leave to go to the airport. And that's really the only example I can use. But I've been using it a lot. It's really great. It's obviously not got the full functionality in terms of, when you turn it off, it's not going to, come up and be really aware of what you need to be doing. But, that's never going to happen, though. So I think it's always going to be slightly limited. So I think Apple kind of foresaw that to a certain extent.
And plus, Apple wouldn't allow anything to go onto the lock screen apart from its own kind of official notifications. And, I have it on, my Nexus 7, and that's Wi-Fi only. So in a sense, it's a bit limited, but still the potential for it is fantastic. So I can only imagine what it's like on, when you have a 3G connection.
Yeah, and I think it's definitely going to be, I think it's very, very presumptuous to say it, but I think kind of with iOS 7 coming forward, I think letting Google onto the software as it is now, and kind of, it's a beautiful piece of, it's a beautiful iOS in terms of the, navigating and going through the cards, and, there's the search functionality, the goggles feature and everything like that. It's such a big step to put it onto the iOS, which is looking a bit old and dated at this stage. And I think it even puts a bit more pressure on, Johnny going forward and making iOS 7. It's going to be really interesting when you have, Google Now on it as well as this new iOS. So I think it's pretty cool.
Yeah, and even with Siri as well, it's kind of leaving it in the dust. So could you see Apple, catching up to it in the sense of what Google Now capabilities, especially when you consider what it's done with, Apple Maps, which was, it was trying to play Google at its own game and it was a disaster. So could you see something like that, or will Apple learn from their mistake?
They kind of have to, don't they? They have to. Yeah. I think they'd have to try and compete.
Yeah, I mean, Siri's just, I don't think I'll ever use Siri, ever. It's such a poor... The one thing about Google Now, anyone was, when you're talking into it, it's the automatic correction of the words that you're putting in. So it's just far more intelligent in the way that you talk. And, I mean, that's just one part of the interface. But, Siri, I've just found, is completely incompetent. And it doesn't seem like it's ever being upgraded, or it never seems like there's ever any improvement in how it understands me. But Google Now just seems like it's always being updated. Google are constantly striving to make every single update of it kind of even more innovative, and I just think it pulls back to iOS 7. It's just going to be a massive jump whether Apple keep up or not.
Could you argue that Google has become as a company now, as both hardware and software, has become far more, has overtaken Apple as an innovative company? So when we talk about like sleek design and fantastic software, we taught Apple for the last few years, but with the arrival of Google Glass and smartwatches and the Nexus 4, Nexus 7, it seems like very much a case that it's Google's day, at least for the next few months.
Yeah, definitely. They have everything to play for, and, well, play, Google Play.
nice.
Yeah, get it in there. But yeah, absolutely, and I suppose this is something that they absolutely have to do, so...
Yeah, I think, to be honest, I think Apple still have the drop on Google in the sense that their hardware is always going to be far superior. And, HTC, with the HTC One, I think, is the only real competitor in terms of a really, really nice-looking piece of, a really nice smartphone. The only thing I'll have is that, Apple have kind of outgunned everyone in terms of design of their products, I think, personally, until now. The iOS is kind of lacking. You can kind of see it's been a huge thing about the iOS 7 concept stuff, and everyone's kind of like, it needs an overhaul, it needs to be done. I kind of keep coming back to, when the next bunch of iPhone come out, the next iOS comes out, it's going to kind of redefine this kind of old big smartphone war. So I wouldn't put anything down yet. I'll wait till that happens.
It's okay, and we'll keep moving on. Anyway, there's a lot of things to discuss with that topic, but I think we probably exhausted Apple for a good one episode, let alone four or five. But moving on from one piece of hardware to a piece of software, kind of the news that Twitter last week saw another hacking problem with Associated Press, Press's account being compromised there, which was quickly removed and then quickly put back up again. And it's probably one of a long line of examples where Twitter accounts have been hacked. And when you think about it, like, there's only one like real line of security, which is a password, and that's it. Lisa, if I can start with you, is Twitter the only social media site out there that has such a lax security system?
It's not. I actually, when you asked me that question, I think, yeah, Facebook is the same, Instagram's the same. I mean, they all just have the password login, but I looked into it a bit further and Facebook actually have several security measures in place in comparison to Twitter. So they have things like you can get login notifications, obviously secure browsing and login approval. You can up your security on Facebook if you take the steps to do so. But with Twitter, it seems like a little bit looser security. And obviously Gmail is the same, or email even is the same. And if people get into your, or if hackers or whatever get into your Gmail, then you're in serious trouble because they probably will get access to all your accounts. But I was looking at kind of, as you said, examples of this happening. And obviously Burger King is probably one of the
biggest examples out there. Yeah.
Yeah, I was just reading that when it was hacked, it was at 71 minutes after it was hacked, 53 tweets were sent from the account, which were retweeted 73,000 times, which is...
Good going for Burger King. I mean, yeah, probably not the effect they wanted, but...
But it is scary. Obviously, I'm a social media manager or whatever on my own account, so you do absolutely have to have the highest levels of security when you're running brand accounts, because if this happens, it's out there, it's retweeted, you can't take the tweets down. And then, of course, MTV pretended their account was hacked, and that didn't go down too well because it was so close.
How did they pretend that was hacked?
They sent out a tweet that made it look like it had been hacked, and then everyone kind of caught that it was them trying to get a bit of PR around it. So it's just, you kind of have to take it seriously.
So what you're trying to say is this is a problem on Twitter for businesses.
Yes.
Every time Twitter gets hacked at one point or another, there's always talk about, oh, it's going to be introducing two-step verification like Gmail and Google products, which is a nice idea. But why haven't Twitter gotten around to doing something like that? Surely that's the obvious step to take.
It should be obviously priority one. I mean, the memo they sent out to news organisations, I think it was in relation to that first example, the AP hack, was basically help us protect you. And the advice they were giving to companies was to designate one computer to use for Twitter. One computer. You're not allowed to surf the web on that computer. So you basically have to have the hardware to go and log into Twitter, which is slightly embarrassing.
Do Twitter not realise that people have more than one device to access their own site? I mean, they've been around for a couple of, seven, eight years now.
They're in this game for a long time, but yeah, they just basically tell people to stay off the internet for using Twitter. So they sent out a couple of steps, like never send passwords via email, even internally. And that's a massive thing. Here in Simply Zesty, we've obviously merged with Tybus, and Mark Kennedy, who's our technical director, has absolutely educated us on security, and that's our main priority. So we have password pushers and protectors and all that kind of stuff that you need in place, but some companies, maybe they don't
specialize
in social media, so they're not going to necessarily know these things.
I was going to say that. That's assuming a lot that the majority of people on Twitter are savvy like ourselves. A lot of them, like you were saying, they're average users. They're not going to think about doing extra security. So how much should Twitter be kind of meeting halfway at the very least, instead of saying, oh, use it on one computer or use like a password security provider? Because out of all the people that are going to, take heed of that, it will only be the ones that are very, very active on Twitter in the first place.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's putting people that are probably even more kind of likely for this to happen in quite a dangerous position. They say things like use 20 character passwords and random generators and everything like that. But it's just, are people actually going to bother doing it? I don't think so in most companies. So it is, it's a massive problem. And as you said, they are looking into it. They haven't given a date as far as I know, but it's something they need to crack down on now.
We're going to end the podcast on this note. So Lisa, Aaron, thanks a million for coming down to chat. So
thanks for having us, Quentin. Bye-bye.
Moving on, with all that's been happening over the last 12 months, many startups and companies are focusing on cracking social music. With the like of iTunes, Spotify integrating into Facebook, and Twitter releasing its own music service, it's an area that has and will be getting a lot of attention over the coming months. One of the apps trying to break into this industry is Soundwave, a beta app that shows you what music people are listening to in a specific area. I spoke to its founder and CEO, Brendan O'Driscoll, and asked him what the overall reception has been like.
Yeah, I mean, to date, it's been a really exciting period that we're in now, where we actually have the product in a stable state that we can actually go ahead and give to a bunch of people and get their feedback. And that's probably been the most satisfying part to date, is having people other than ourselves and our mothers using the app and seeing them really enjoying it and getting addicted to it, and most importantly finding new music through it as well. So it's been a really good period to be in right now.
And because it's in beta mode, you have a very, very core set of users. I myself included, I've been playing around with it for the last day or two, found it a lot of fun, love the map feature. I'll get to later, but for those who probably aren't as trendy as myself or ourselves, how would you describe the app?
Sure. I mean, it all starts off with a problem that we had, I suppose, is we thought that finding new music was a bit of a chore. So really, as a result of that, and a couple of late nights brainstorming, we thought it'd be really cool if there was an app out there that would seamlessly and instantly kind of pull in all the songs that you were playing and then give you the ability to see what songs other people were playing too. So whether they're your friends or your community or the local area you live in, or just the ability to plug in instantly and see what songs are actually being played as opposed to being talked about or purchased or anything else. So that's really what we wanted to do, and that's how Soundwave was born.
And that social element is a massive part of it as well, and I'm not talking about Facebook or Twitter integration. I'm talking about the fact of the music map itself, almost social in the sense that you see somebody that listening to like Pastille or the XX or Hot Chip or whatever, and you'd be able to go up to them and talk to them, either say, hey, I like this band as well. So like there's a very literal social element to it as well. Was that intended, or is that side effect?
Yeah, I mean, I think music and music discovery in general is quite social, all the way going back to when people were in their bedroom making mixtapes to each other, to sharing, CDs or emailing each other MP3 files. It's always been finding through music has generally been through your peers and your community and your network. So that's just, I suppose, the next stage of that.
As I mentioned before, the music map is the main feature of it, and it's a brilliantly simple aspect of the app and the music discovery in general. It's one of those things that you think is very simple. You know, it's very simple, but you're kind of wondering how nobody has taught of it. I told it before. I mean, how much work did it take to put that together? I mean, like, it's, again, as I said, it's a very simple idea, but I imagine, you know, the reality would have been a lot more complicated to get all those different tunes and music together and on the one map.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly it. It's kind of like a swan, you know, very, very simple and easy on the top, above the water, but below the water we were paddling at a million miles an hour trying to get all that together. But I suppose what it is we thought it'd be cool to tag the location where people were listening to their music as well. And then the map then allows you to easily and very intuitively just draw a circle over any particular area of interest and see the songs that are playing in that area and the top played songs. So I suppose the idea was born from, you know, various different influences that we had in terms of music. So I in particular, a fan of hip-hop, so just the idea of being able to pan over to Brooklyn, New York on a map and draw a circle around it, filter then by hip-hop and then select top played, then now I'm instantly plugged into the latest, greatest kind of breaking tunes coming out of that area. And I think if you look at music trends as they emerge, they're all born out of particular locations as well. So you can kind of plug into New Orleans for kind of the latest, greatest jazz, or you can plug into wherever suits your fancy.
So in a sense, it's also a very cultural app because, in Dublin, we have a very developed indie rock scene. And the same with different, Brooklyn and New Orleans
Exactly.
Well.
You're a student and you're going to the library and you want to study, you don't know what to listen to, you look around and everyone else has headphones on, you're wondering, what are these other 1,000 people listening to? Then now you can kind of quickly and easily find out. Or if you want to know your local gym or your local neighborhood or the city you grew up in, you can just as easily figure out the songs that are playing there and use that as a means to discover new music.
The other, you know, particularly clever aspect of Soundwave as well is the fact that you can listen to the preview of it. I think that goes through, is that through iTunes or?
Yeah, so for the Android app, we're using 7 Digital, and then for the iPhone app, we're using iTunes. So once you have discovered a song, from the main activity feed, you can preview the song, so just kind of get a taster or a 30-second clip.
And that leads to the fact that you can listen to it on YouTube and SoundCloud, yeah. And I'm particularly happy SoundCloud's involved in it as well, because a lot of people forget that's a pretty popular place for kind of new emerging artists to showcase their tracks.
Exactly, yeah. So I mean, once you have discovered that song, you can click into it, you can look at the full YouTube video, you can stream it on SoundCloud, or you can purchase it. So it gets kind of completes that cycle of music discovery, you know. So I mean, we're delighted to be working with YouTube and with SoundCloud on that and delivering that service through Soundwave.
If I'm correct in saying this, you guys decided to develop the app first on Android and then later on iOS, is that correct?
Yeah.
What was the reasoning behind that? Was it just easier to develop on Android, or was there kind of a deeper reasoning behind it?
A combination of a number of factors. Our particular interests, I suppose, were slightly weighed towards Android. Our skill set as well was slightly weighed towards Android. And then just in general, looking at the markets and the way things were going, there seemed to be kind of a turning point where Android just seems to be kind of a land of possibility at the minute, and a lot more exciting and free and open to develop on. And we thought that was really exciting to be part of that. And also, we've always had quite a good relationship with Google. So just leveraging that, we thought it'd be really cool to lead with an Android and make sure, I suppose, the biggest overriding thing we wanted to make sure of was that the Android app was actually an Android app, and not just what so many people do is take their iPhone app and port it across to Android. And that's just not a great experience for Android users. And I think if you build an Android app for Android users, then they'll appreciate that and, you know, be happy that.
And also, there's, you know, different users would have different ways of consuming the same medium, because obviously iPhones are very based on apps, whereas Android is very widget based as well. So it's kind of developing that experience to cater for both.
We just wanted to make sure that we were listening to both sets of users and not trying to have a one fixed solution for both and kind of half keep everybody happy. We wanted to have a dedicated build for iPhone users and a dedicated build for Android. And I think the extra work that we took to ensure that happened has paid off, and we're getting really positive reviews from both communities now.
And you guys are entering a pretty exciting time in kind of music discovery and social music as well. Like, you have the obvious ones like Spotify and radio and so on, but you also have the likes of Twitter Music coming out as well, which is trying to, it's, you know, in the case of Twitter Music, it's not a big step, it's a tiny step, but it's a step towards kind of shaking up the status quo.
Yeah.
Where do you see SoundCloud, or Soundwave, beg your pardon, fitting into all of this?
So, I mean, our goal from day one was to provide an objective overview of what songs people are actually listening to, regardless of what service they're using, whether they're using their native player, whether they're using a streaming service or any other type of way of consuming the music. So our goal really is to essentially become a unified music feed that acts as a kind of a viewfinder or a window into what people are actually listening to. And I think you see so many companies and so many startups tackling the music discovery problem, and the way they're trying to tackle it is by overcomplicating things. So they come up with crazy algorithms that try and predict music based on your hair color or what you ate for lunch, or you see sentiment analysis trying to predict what music you should listen to based on your mood, and all we're trying to do is dig deep into the heart of what's actually happening, of what songs are actually going through people's headphones and into their ears, because at the end of the day, that's all we care about, and we think that.
Do you think that simplicity is where social music has to go to evolve properly, instead of trying to create all these massive algorithms?
Yeah, I think so. It comes back to you know, again, the basics of how used to spread, and that was just through word of mouth. What songs are you listening to? What band did you go see? What CD did you just buy? These are all questions that we've been asking each other for years, and I think until now we haven't had a simple, easy way to do that technically, and that's why we built Soundwave to fill that problem.
And overall, how do you see the entire kind of music spectrum or discovery spectrum evolving over the next couple of years? Will it be like kind of like what Soundwave is going for, geographical? Will it be kind of a mixture of you know, social, Facebook or so on, or be all of these different factors accumulating together to be one, you know, massive happy family?
Yeah, I mean, the music space is really, really interesting right now. There's a lot happening. I think for years, the music industry was reluctant to embrace technology. And I think now the tides are turning and they can see how they can use technology in their favor. There's bigger debates going on as to, you know, the streaming model and whether that's a sustainable model, and whether, you know, cloud lockers or music lockers will win out, or streaming services, or whether purchasing MP3s will be the one that wins out. But I think it's an exciting time to be involved in all this, because we've carved our path now, and we can adjust and modify as is necessary. But it's just exciting to be part of such a kind of a rebirth or emergence of this new kind of space.
And to finish up, what is going to be in the pipeline for Soundwave over the next couple of months? You have the launch to look forward to.
Yes.
I can guess that alone through the beta tag. But when do you hope to officially launch on?
So we're looking at, we're really happy with how the beta is going right now. We're taking all the appropriate steps to make sure that we're iterating on the feedback from our beta testers. And that's a process that we're really comfortable with now. And looking, as a result of that positive feedback, we're looking at opening it up this summer more to a more public, much wider launch. You know, so we've got that to look forward to, and we've a number of other interesting developments that we're looking forward to talking about soon as well that are in the pipeline.
And just to finish up as well, the users that are currently on the service as well, are they a mixture of friends and family? Was that true word of mouth?
It was amazing, actually. It was mostly all word of mouth. We've had quite a long waiting list of people to get on the beta for quite a while now, and we've been slowly opening that out to more and more beta testers from a wide range and diverse range of different places. But one of the interesting things we did just as a little experiment ourselves was we created a little flash game that we put up on our website, and we challenged potential beta testers.